slip right in among the very heart of you. Sign in, sign on the dotted line. You checked out, you check in. I don't mean you didn't.
Well, welcome to Mental Health Radio. Take it from us. I'm Sheldon Brown, and Take It From Us is brought to you by Framework. You've been listening to our theme music from Sarita Murdoch's Many Lines, and we're building up to quite a big milestone, I guess, in Take It From Us's history. I've been hosting Mental Health Radio for 10 years of continuous mental health broadcasting this month. That's more than 500 radio shows, different guests, different issues, but all about psych stuff, which is what Take It From Us specialises in. I'll say more about this milestone on the actual date of October the 17th, a couple of Tuesdays away. In the meantime, we'll be featuring guest interviews where the enormity of guest challenges and the quality of their achievements and recovery have been outstanding. So today we revisit a personal story where our guest describes her upbringing as guerrilla warfare. It's a sometimes harrowing story which some might find hard to believe could happen here in God's own country. So let's revisit the personal life experience of Liz. We've withheld her surname. As she grows up and how it impacted her mental and emotional health. Well, Liz, wonderful to have you on Take It From Us, and we've mentioned your experiences in the last two programs talking about post-traumatic stress disorder. What was your life like growing up as a young girl?
Thank you for having me. I appreciate you having me on. Like I summated in the last couple of episodes, I grew up in two decades of domestic violence. So basically I was terrified of my parents for two decades, and I believed that they would kill me based on their behaviour, really.
I think you described that it was like growing up in the trenches. Is that a fair description?
Yes, that is a fair description. And so hence the post-traumatic stress disorder, you know, the sort of the association with being a soldier in a war zone. And it was effectively a war zone for the two decades I was part of it. My parents were married for 22 decades, so it really was a 22 years of, of a war zone, really. And my sisters and I were sort of born into that. So unlike a soldier that has a civilian life before you go to war, we didn't have any recollection of a life before that.
So it started right from year dot, really?
As far as I can recall, really, I'm the oldest, so I don't remember a period before it.
And you had how many other sisters? How many sisters?
I've got two younger sisters, one that is 2.5 years younger than me, and another sister who's much younger, who's 10 years younger than me. So the sister who's closer in age to me, we had a much more similar experience, but by the time my youngest sister came along, the violence was still there, but it was manifesting in a different way.
Yeah, how did that violence manifest itself? I mean, I don't know whether you're comfortable to talk about that, but we can talk generally about domestic violence without really knowing what the detail is.
The details are pretty straightforward. It was very much a sort of once were warriors childhood. Of course, some things were different, but the level of constant fear and the threat of violence was just an absolute constant, really. My sister, who's closer in age to me, we were beaten by my father for the first decade of our lives, roughly, for myself anyway. And then it shifted once my younger sister came along for a variety of reasons, really. But the level of violence and the constant fear was still the same, really. And I guess, I'd sort of talk about, I'm pretty certain that I was beaten before I went to school. So, that I would have weighed, maybe 15 kilos at the time. And my father was an average-sized man, so he weighed about 85, roughly. So that's the force of six grown men if they came into your studio right now. And, you know, the anger involved in it, the level of rage. So you could imagine being held captive by six rageful men for 5 years.
Yeah.
That's pretty much, you know, the first 5 years of my life. And there wasn't, I was at home with my parents for those years. There wasn't a preschool or a kindergarten, or my parents certainly never looked into it.
So you had no relief from it by, I guess you're suggesting that if there was a childcare or a preschool, you would have had some relief from the violence.
Sort of, but the flip side of that was but of course I was always frightened anyway. So because they were my parents, I saw the whole world through them. I just imagined that the rest of the world would treat me the same the way they were, because that was my experience, really. I didn't have any other experience. So when I went to school, I was born with red hair, quite bright red hair, and when I went to school it went white. And that was the shock of going out into the world. And now all of a sudden, there wasn't just two people who might kill me. There was a whole world of people out there.
That was the effect of this, that you didn't trust anybody out in the world as a result of what was happening at home.
No, because they're the two people that you learn, you know, most things about the world in those first 5 years, really. For me, anyway, like, there weren't any other, you know, major adult. There was one, but it was a really minor contribution. I could blame my parents or I could get into that, but really it was a whole community thing. My parents lived in a neighbourhood, there were teachers, there were doctors, there was extended family. You know, so there were people who, if they didn't know, they definitely heard or saw or, you know, it was a community issue, really.
How did your parents behave with other people, like you're talking about the community? How did they behave in the community? Did they express anger or frustration, or were they model community members?
No, my father was definitely an angry person, so most people avoided him, to the point that no one came to our house. And my mother was just very withdrawn and quiet. She was, able to sort of, you know, be polite and get along with people, but she was very withdrawn and very quiet. And I was effectively the same as a child going to school, withdrawn and quiet. But, of course, in a school setting, that's considered quite good.
Yeah. Your mother's withdrawal and quietness and that sort of thing, do you think that she also was on the receiving end of violence?
To my knowledge, not until a bit later, but of course as a child you're not privy to everything, but she was definitely very frightened for a very long time, really. And it's this, you know, I've had experiences of being terrified of a partner, you know, in my adult life, and you know, being terrified of an intimate relationship, in an intimate relationship, is really difficult, because you're lying next to this person that night who you think might potentially kill you. So, you know, that is, you know, does it get any more terrifying than that, really?
So they're the sort of repercussions of 20 years of growing up in violence. Just before we sort of get on onto that, I mean, as I get older, I think quite a lot about, the role model of my parents. And, I mean, they are our guides and our sort of ambassadors and champions and that sort of thing, aren't they? But in your case, that was all completely stuffed up.
Yes. Well, yeah, no, they were engaged in their 20-year war. I was a very intelligent child, and in the last 2 years of high school, I got straight A's. And I remember, I wasn't aware that I'd done that until I got my last sort of report card, and another school child had pointed it out to me. And so I went home with this and was going to show my mother, and she was too busy involved in the war zone, really, with my father. So basically, you don't get any parental support at all, much.
Just to clarify there, you it took a friend to point out that you had got straight A's in the exam.
Yes.
I mean, normally, normally that's one of the first things after an examination that we look at. Why did you ignore that?
Because I wasn't living in my body. I was just completely dissociated until I was about 27. I just wasn't present, really. And I got such good grades because I was a workaholic. And that's what I used to cope with what was going on, really. I could sit in my bedroom and do my schoolwork. And that meant I was doing something constructive and industrious, and I was left alone. And so that was my way of kind of removing myself as much as I could, even though physically I was still there and I could still hear what was going on.
Achieving straight A's in the violence that you were growing up in, I mean, that makes that a super achievement, doesn't it? Is that the way you look at it?
Well, it seems to, but in actual fact, you know, if I was to do it now as myself, I probably wouldn't be a straight-A student. I'd probably be more sporty and a bit more well-rounded than I really was. And, yeah, of course, I came out in the top 5% of my year when I left high school, so I could have gone into medicine. But I couldn't actually have a conversation with anybody because I was so terrified all the time. So what was the point, really?
Yeah.
And the irony of that isn't lost on me, and I guess that's why I draw attention to it, because there is a stereotypical idea that, you know, children who come from domestic violence situations, you know, don't do well at school, that they, you know, but it's not true. It's always a complex mix when you're a human being.
So much, it sounds as though so much was robbed from you in this 20 years. Clearly you were somebody who was very bright, regarded doing well as being very important. And yet, as you say, there was very limited ability to relate to anyone, which must have isolated you terribly further, in fact.
Well, yeah, absolutely, yeah, and it did. But I couldn't maintain relationships with people because, you know, based on my experience of my first experience of my parents' relationship to myself, and it wasn't like all of what I'm telling, well, most of all of what I'm telling you now, I've only really learnt to articulate through years of psychotherapy. When I was living in it, and up until the age of, well, probably 41, I wouldn't have been able to articulate it as well. Definitely when I was living in it, I had very limited capacity to practically say anything about what was going on for me. I learned in psychotherapy, when I was 32, I learned that for my whole life I had believed that I was not a human being, and that was up to the age of 32. It's not like I believed I was better than a person. I believed I was way less. You know, I was just believed I was the most revolting thing on the planet. And that's a really, for me, that happened because I was treated inhumanely as a child for a very long time. And as a result, I believed I was inhuman.
Well, what other repercussions? I mean, that's a tragic and traumatic repercussion in itself, but what other repercussions were there in terms of, say, the potential to work or the potential to have intimate relationships or the potential to have friends?
Yeah, well, absolutely. Yeah, no, that just all went down the drain, effectively. And, you know, I left high school and it looked on paper that I had truckloads of potential, but the reality was that I just couldn't stick with anything. I would just be terrified all the time, and I didn't really know that there was anything wrong with me, and I didn't know what was wrong with me, really. So for up until the age of 27, I just sort of muddled along, really. I worked a bit, but not much. I went to art school, which was an environment where my eccentric behaviour was kind of just seen as eccentric.
you fitted in with all the other eccentrics.
Well, not really. I didn't really communicate with anybody. But I passed, I guess. And so, not many, like, I did very well academically, but I passed as being, my behaviour was sort of, well, kind of acceptable, but to my thinking now, you know, alarm bells were ringing all over the place if I see somebody that was like myself, because I basically couldn't really communicate with anybody, and I lived with my mother up until I was about 30, and I started psychotherapy when I was 27.
What about the desire to reach out to people and have friends? And was that just too frightening a prospect?
Yeah, well, absolutely. I wanted everything that everybody else had, really. You know, I could see it, sort of, right from attending school, you know, from going to school. I could see that other people had these things, but I had no idea how you got there, really. And I remember a friend trying to show me how to play chess, and she kind of showed me what all the, you know, the little characters did, but she didn't show me how to win. And that effectively was kind of my life, really.
It can be a hard game to win chess.
I didn't even have any idea what you had to do to get there. I knew what the little characters did, you know, whatever they're called, to move, how they moved around.
The pieces,
how they moved around, but I didn't know the alignment that you needed to create, you know, some chance of winning. So I could see people having friends and relationships and partners, but I just didn't know how you got that.
So, I mean, one step, I guess a first step might be to ask some questions. Was that, did you feel just totally fearful of even asking questions of somebody?
You mean like asking, how do you be friends?
How do you be friends, or how do you win at chess, or how do you...
I guess I was too afraid. I guess to use the chess example, I would have been so immensely gratified that anybody was spending 2 seconds with me, that this person was showing me how to do this. I would have been so grateful that she was spending 10 minutes, and that would have been the main thing. I wouldn't have got past that. Yeah. I would have been amazed that somebody was spending 10 minutes with me to show me something.
And perhaps were you a little bit over the top about that generosity from that person, and maybe that frightened them away?
I don't know. I was 10 years old. I don't know. No, I just... my parents didn't encourage us to be social at all. In fact, they pretty much did the opposite. They were quite happy with us not having relationships, because that was difficult for them, really. And I remember my mother with parent-teacher interviews. She was hugely relieved when she didn't have to go to them anymore, because it highlighted their functioning in the world, which, you know, just wasn't really. So they didn't want to draw attention to that, and we did that by going out into the world and bringing the world back home in that way. And they didn't want to draw attention to it.
Do you think the fact that they didn't function very well, sort of they wanted to impose that on you, so that they didn't get shown up or get jealous or whatever the theory might have been?
I don't think it was a deliberate thing. And I think there was a lot of shame, especially for my mother, involved in everything about our lives. So it was never deliberate. It was a survival. You know, everything in that time period was a survival mechanism. Mm. Everything for all of us. You know, we are in the trenches, all five of us. So it's all just a survival thing. And it's all it's a cultural thing, and it's a generational thing as well. My mother was married in the 60s. And she didn't come from an environment that was sort of open-minded to the idea of leaving a violent relationship.
Right.
So there was a lot of shame, and even still, I don't know, making the wrong choice when you married the wrong person, really. I can't really speak for my mother, but that's just my assumption of that time period and her generation and her growing up. But of course, there was people that did. I know she tried at least once, I can remember, but I have since learnt that on average, a person tries 10 times to leave a relationship like that. That's the average, really. So some people try more before they succeed, and some people try less, but 10 times is the average.
Yeah. Well, it sounds as though, she wasn't equipped to survive in the real world either, in the way that you describe her. But let's come back and talk a little bit about the impact of fear and fright in our lives, and particularly impacting on our mental health. Well, this is Mental Health Radio, take it from us, and we're replaying a, well, what is quite a harrowing interview with Liz. It's a story about being in the trenches, but within a family environment. We're replaying some outstanding interviews to sort of build up to a milestone of, well, my hosting of Take It From Us for 10 continuous years. So let's take a music break, and we've got Declan Curran here to introduce our song.
Yeah, I'm not swinging around the roof like a gremlin on a ceiling fan either. Excuse, I've got that funny throat. This song I'm playing, I've played before once when I was on a guest on a show actually that Sheldon did some years ago, and it's from a guy called Simon Webb. He's he's gone out single on his own actually. He's from Boy Band Blue. And the song is Lay Your Hands, very appropriate for a mental health program.
You're with Take It From Us on 104.6 Planet FM.
Sometimes life can be a burden, trying to stay one step ahead. Feel the world upon my shoulder each time I'm standing out on the edge. My hopes have all deserted me, like they're washed away in the sand. And it's hurting my pride, trying to survive, but I know that I stand a chance when you lay your hands.
What you say, what you feel.
Oh yeah.
Cause
it's the only thing I have that still makes sense. Oh, baby, when I'm falling down, give me love and affection. Keep telling me, show me the way. Oh, if you see me falling down, lift me up from the shadows. Will you take me away to a better place? When I'm in my darkest hour, be by my side to turn the tide into the suffering fades. When life is getting hands on me.
What you do, what you say, what you feel. What you do, lift your hands to the
healing. This road is getting longer now, and I'm too far away from home. Instead, I gotta keep on moving on, but I can't do it on my own. Baby, keep my head above water. Help me swim for my life. Cause the game is getting harder, the strain is getting stronger, and I can only face the fight when you lay your hands.
What you
do,
what you say, what you feel.
Oh yeah.
What you do, lift your hands to the healing.
Cause it's the only thing I have that still makes sense. Oh baby, when I'm falling down, give me love and affection. Keep telling me, show me the way. Oh, if you see me falling down, lift me up from the shadows. Will you take me away to a better place? When I'm in my darkest hour, be by my side to turn the tide into the suffering fades. When life is getting me down, close to death. Come and lay your hands on me till I'm healed. Those bitter blues are gone. Oh,
feel the pain, feel the strain.
Take me away to a better place. When I'm in my darkest hour, be by my side to turn the tide until the suffering.
You're with Take It From Us on 104.6 Planet FM.
And we're listening to an interview on Mental Health Radio, Take It From Us, which we broadcast a couple of years ago. It's an interview with Liz about her upbringing, which she describes as guerrilla warfare. This interview is all part of acknowledging some of the outstanding interviews that we've been able to bring to listeners in the 10 years of continuous hosting that I've been involved in. So I think we're ready to go with this interview with Liz and leading up to how this violence and guerrilla warfare impacted her life and particularly her mental health. Liz Manson today, who has a harrowing story, really, to tell about her early years living with her parents and the violence associated with living with her parents. But, Liz, one of my beliefs is that fear is one of the most eroding things to our mental health. When I get fearful, I know that my mental health is likely to go down the gurgler. How have you managed this fright and fear of, well, probably 30 years to come out in recovery?
I guess for a long time I didn't really manage it when I was, you know, very sick. And, I guess as a child you developed, some coping strategies just based on the limited resources that were available to me. So being a workaholic, I guess, would have been the predominant thing. Both my parents were, in their own ways, workaholics. So I sort of picked up on that and basically for a long time just kept working, kept my head down, really. When I was 27, I guess it all sort of came to a head a bit, where I realised that if I had a problem in my life, then I would go and work, and it didn't really solve the problem. Really, it just was a way of avoiding things.
Wasn't there a risk of burnout there? I mean, us workaholics eventually burn out.
No, I guess because the fear was greater than the constant level of terror that I lived in was the predominant thing, really. Everything else just fell beside the wayside. Yeah, maybe if I'd crashed and burned, but I didn't. And I guess, you know, up until I was 27, I was pretty physically robust. So just kept going and going and going. So it looks like I'm a high achiever because I'm working. But in actual fact, I'm not doing anything else at all, really, whatsoever.
So it was a combination of sort of workaholism, if there is such a word, and terror. I would have burnt out, I think, after a few years of that.
Well, yeah, and in all honesty, I should have burnt out when I was about 5 years old. But that wasn't going to happen. Because I didn't, I think, you know, I might suffer burnout now as an adult because I've had a period of being relaxed in my life. But I never had a period of being relaxed. I didn't know what being relaxed was.
Could we talk about your experience with mental health services? It sounds as though the year of 27 in your life was quite significant, and 27 does seem to be a very significant year in many people's lives. Many pop stars die at the age of 27. Did you feel a significance when you got to 27?
At the time, I wouldn't have been able to have said that, but definitely. Yeah, no, something happened when I was 27. I guess for me, up until the age of 27, when I was 27, I could not believe I had lived that long. I honestly thought that I would have died a lot earlier. So there was a sense of disbelief, like, oh my goodness, I can't believe I'm still alive. And also a realisation that I was never going to get my childhood back, really, it was a belief that I'd had for right up until I was 27, when I realised no, it's I'm never going to get to be a child now. Yeah. Next is 30, and that's definitely adulthood. And so I guess up until I was 27, I did really believe that I wouldn't get a chance to be a child because I'd never had that.
How did you imagine that was going to happen?
Oh, well, it was a part of the delusional thinking that I had. I didn't have any idea how it would happen. But, of course, at the same time, when I'm 27, I also believe that I'm not a human being. So that opens up a plethora of doorways when you believe you're not a human being. So, you know, because of the way I grew up, I had a lot of ideas about the world that just weren't real. Mm. They weren't, yeah.
So when did you have your first experience with mental health services?
Well, when I was 27, I started seeing a psychotherapist weekly, and that was in, she was in private practice, and I didn't really choose that to be that way, but I started seeing her when I was studying, and then I finished studying, and so I carried on seeing her because I didn't feel like I had any choice, really. I was so sick. And I also started seeing her because I was afraid that I would hurt somebody. And that had been going on for about a decade. The sort of fantasies of that had happened for about a decade. And by the time I was 27, I was concerned. It had happened, it was happening so much that I was concerned.
You mean the belief, the thoughts of hurting somebody, but what I can't quite understand, I'm a bit confused about that. What did you want, did you have somebody singled out that you wanted to hurt, or just anybody?
No, I didn't have anybody singled out. And it wasn't anybody, like I wasn't sort of deciding to have this happen. It was just a constant fantasies all the time. And I was able to, you know, make a limited sort of sense of it, was that it was a manifestation of the reality of my life, really, the fantasies that I was having. But that didn't mean they went away. They were still there.
Were you living on your own, isolated and just working?
No, but my life was in deficit so much when I looked at other people's lives, you know, like who were 27 and, you know, sort of intelligent and doing interesting things, and then I looked at my own life, and the gap was so wide that I couldn't, the pain of that was phenomenal, really. And also, because I didn't believe that I was a human being, it opened up the doorways into, you know, homicidal fantasies and that kind of thing. Yeah, the fact that I didn't believe I was a human being just meant that kind of thought process.
What did you think you were?
Oh, the most revolting thing you can imagine. Something off the X-Files that lived in a sewer, pretty much summates it, really. And I couldn't have told you that because I wasn't aware of it until I'd had a period of not thinking that when I was 32.
You lived with your mother up until the age of 30, is that right?
Yes, that's right.
How was she with you starting to see a psychotherapist?
I did not tell her.
She didn't know?
No, I didn't tell her at first, yeah.
Not telling her suggests that there's very limited, emotional communication between you and your mother?
We had a codependent relationship up until I started psychotherapy, primarily because I was the oldest child, not for any other reason. I was just, you know, the next person. So she developed a codependent relationship with me from probably, you know, I was about 10, really, where I started feeling like I was her spouse. Mm-hmm. And my father kind of, yeah, he sort of perpetuated in that, and he was always telling me to look after my mother. And so that's effectively what I did up until I was, well, I continued it for quite some time, but definitely up until I was 30. You know, I sort of took care of her because he wasn't, and nobody else was. Actually.
But again, that sort of militates against you as a 20 or 30 year old having your own independent life and your friends and work colleagues and generally developing a life of your own.
Yeah, which I couldn't, you know. And I, it, it's yeah that that was almost an effect of us growing the way we grew up, really, was that I wasn't able to do that. Because, like I said, up until I was 27, I honestly believed that I would get a shot at being a child.
The word control comes into my mind all the time listening to your interview and your comments. Do you think that this was just a total control strategy?
You mean on the part of my parents or on
yes.
the part of me? Or?
No, on the part of your parents.
I don't, you know, like they got married when they were 20, which was kind of the thing you did in their age, you know, in their generation. And I don't think they, you know, and then they had children, so quite quickly, sort of a year or two later. I don't think they stepped, like I know from my own, when I was 20, how much of a mess I was.
Some very good reasons to be a mess, I would suggest.
But I don't think, especially my father, his childhood was no different from my own.
Right.
So it's just a repeat cycle, really.
So the violence that they imparted on you, you think had been meted out to them by your grandparents?
By my father's parents, definitely, yes. And I don't see violence as something that is attached to a person specifically. I kind of see it as this amorphous bubble of things that kind of moves around, really. And it's just like anxiety is contagious. It's not something that is fixed to a particular person, really. And I saw it in my own growing up. The violence was still there. It just shifted around and manifested in a different way. Because things change. You know, human beings change. We don't ever stay in the same place all the time. I had 20 years of violence, but it was never the same all the time.
I'm thinking about your comment when you said you, if you lie with somebody, that they could turn on you. You know, just suggests that you're constantly vigilant, you're constantly in fear and constantly worried when you're going to get whacked, if you like.
That's a fair summation of the first two decades of my life. And that's one of the reasons why I did so well at school, really, is that I didn't want to give anybody else an excuse to whack me,
was the violence associated with you sort of not doing as well as you were expected to do, or was it more than that?
You mean why I was hit?
Well, it just sounded in your comment that you didn't want to be beaten by anybody else, and that was the reason you wanted to do well. I mean, if you failed, was that a recipe for getting beaten?
Potentially. At the time, I guess the beatings were meted out as a kind of discipline. But, of course, I can't even remember what I did beforehand to make... Well, what would justify six men walking into the room and beating you for 5 years? Is there a justification for that?
Sorry, that little comment that you made there, six men coming into...
Well, that was the equivalent of it.
Right, because
you
were...
15 kilos when it started, and the size... I don't think people realise the size differential. You know, it was... an entity that was six times the size of me,
yes.
That was coming at me with rage and force and then physically, you know, hurting me. And literally it's like being hit by a train. Mm. And that's, you know, something that in the next day you're sitting having breakfast together.
Yeah, extraordinary, isn't it? Let's take another music break.
Take it from us, Community Notice Board. Thanks to the Like Minds, Like Mind campaign and framework.
And we've got Mental Health Awareness Week coming up next week. It runs from the 9th of October through to the 15th. And the Mental Health Foundation, which is responsible for events associated with Mental Health Awareness Week, issued a press release yesterday saying that a record number of people, organisations and workplaces have signed up to take part in Mental Health Awareness Week. The Mental Health Foundation says it's been blown away today by the support and enthusiasm for the Awareness Week around the whole of New Zealand. Now, the theme for Mental Health Awareness Week is reminding Kiwis that nature is key. And the Mental Health Foundation's Chief Executive, Sean Robinson, says that the Foundation is encouraging Kiwis from all walks of life to stop thinking of nature as something locked away in national parks and forests, but as the daisies on the berm, the tree outside the window, and the vast, beautiful sky above. Spending time in nature helps to grow, support and nurture our mental health and well-being. And he says, when I go for a jog or a surf, it helps to restore me when I feel run down, and it helps to keep stress at bay. For some people, connecting with nature means taking time to look out the window or keeping a photo of a special place on your desk. There are lots of meaningful ways each of us can unlock our well-being by spending time with nature every day. And last week on Take It From Us, we mentioned that one of the events in Mental Health Awareness Week is a national lockout. And this is actually going to be held on World Mental Health Day, which is next Tuesday, the 10th of October. So the whole goal here is to get New Zealanders thinking about how easy it is to schedule in some quality time with nature. So from 12 to 1 o'clock and next Tuesday on the 10th of October, Kiwis will head outside and discover how happiness and well-being blooms when we start to connect with the green and blue spaces that surround us every day. And I know at Framework there is some talk of us taking some time out to perhaps drive to the Botanic Gardens or to Totara Park, as we are based in Otahuhu. So it says, busy, stressful workplaces can lead to reduced productivity, absenteeism and high turnover. And it can also lead to burnout, which is a subject that Take It From Us has covered recently. And you could check out our interviews about burnout on www.takeitfromus.co.nz. So Chief Executive of the Mental Health Foundation says spending quality time with nature will support your staff to feel happier and more productive. Now, there's also a Mad Hatter's Tea Party planned during Mental Health Awareness Week. This is being organised by Changing Minds, and you can learn more on the Changing Minds website at changingminds.org.nz. Okay, well, let's go back to this interview with Liz, revelations of her upbringing and life with Liz, and the impact of violence and abuse on her mental health and really her emotional and adult life. With guest Liz Manson, who's been telling us about her upbringing, a horrific upbringing. Liz, when did you actually enter the sort of mainstream public mental health services?
I would have been 30 when I walked into EPS.
EPS being?
Emergency Psychiatric Services, sorry, yes.
Whereabouts was that?
That was in Dunedin.
Right, so what was happening for you to just walk into an emergency psychiatric service?
By then I'd been seeing a psychotherapist for about 3 or 4 years, and so once I started psychotherapy, everything of all those years that I hadn't felt just came rushing back at 100 miles an hour. So I was like, it was basically just a life of post-traumatic stress disorder, really. I was hallucinating a lot. I was really basically just struggling all the time to remain in touch with reality, with enough reality, really. And I walked into EPS because I'd heard that somebody ran a group for people, like for people who had anxiety and depression, which was all that I knew I had at the time, or I just thought I had anxiety, really.
But that, not even that had been officially diagnosed.
No. And I walked into EPS and I could tell, like, there was some nurses around, and I could tell by the way they were looking at me that they thought there was something wrong with me. And that was kind of weird, but you get used to that after a while. And then I saw a nurse, and I was asking her about this group and telling her about what was happening in my life, and she asked me if I wanted to be assessed by a psychiatrist.
I mean, was it natural for people to just walk in off the street and do what you did?
I don't know. I'm not a psychiatric nurse. I've got no idea. That was my first contact. I was on my way to pick up a job interview, and I saw this sign that said psychiatric services, and I thought they might know something about this group that somebody had mentioned. So right. I walked in and asked them over the counter, and they all looked at me like I'd landed from Mars.
What was the next thing that happened then?
I saw a psychiatric nurse in a little room, and she asked me some questions. I can't remember exactly, but I do remember her asking me if I thought I should be assessed, and I didn't know what she was talking about.
So what happened then?
She made a referral. I wasn't assessed. I went home and tried to survive, and she made a referral through to outpatient group therapy program, which the hospital was running at the time.
But it sounded as though you were in a state of disarray, mental health disarray.
Oh, yeah, I was incredibly sick, very, very sick. Yeah.
Would you say you were at crisis?
Oh, it's beyond. I've been in crisis for a long time.
Right.
Somewhere beyond that point.
Yeah.
But how did you survive those crisis circumstances? I mean, most of us, when we get into crisis, or me anyway, I need help immediately. And that might be in the form of the crisis team or the community mental health centre, a psychiatrist or a hospital.
Well, I guess, again, I hadn't had a period of not living in crisis. You know, my whole life had been crisis. And I just basically, like, my life was very small. I was working in a very limited capacity. Well, then my job had just finished. And I didn't have any relationships much. You know, my life was really tiny. So in that way, I could kind of manage it. Basically, I kept my head down. And at that stage, I'd lost quite a lot of weight. But of course, they didn't know that because they'd never seen me before.
So you went on to get further help, if that's the right word, from the mental health system, but I understand that help wasn't particularly useful.
I did get referred to outpatient group therapy program, and that was 18 months of very good assistance, and I wouldn't have survived if I hadn't have had that. I will always be eternally grateful for that because, it made a really big difference in my life.
So you were working with other people, and that's often a great insight. The sharing that we get from other people illuminates us, doesn't it?
Oh, yeah, well, I've been alone with this for 30 years, and it was such a relief to hear somebody else talking about having the same experience and the same struggle because, you know, it's not something I could talk about in my life. I'd never heard anybody articulate it before, really, and I learnt a lot of, you know, what I'm able to do now in that setting, really. And the great thing about the group setting was that, I'd been alone with a psychotherapist once a week for 3 years, but here she was. She just economically, socially, culturally, she was miles away from me. And I was paying money for it, which was effectively very difficult. So it was really hard to create a relationship in that situation.
Liz, but did she recognise the crisis that you were in and refer you to somebody who could have diagnosed you so that you at least had a starting point to know what you were dealing with?
No, she didn't.
At no point did she identify your level of crisis?
No, not at all.
So how did you feel about that?
Once I got to outpatient groups and started working out how she'd let me down, I was not very happy about that. But I continued seeing her because, because I'm so sick at the time, I just don't have the resources to change too much, really. I learnt a lot about myself in the group process. Just hearing other people's stories who were further along from me, who were weller, so I could kind of see where I might want to be. And then later on, you know, I could hear other people were in the same place that I'd been in a while ago. And so I was able to sort of offer, you know, something for them. Well, look, mate, I was there.
Right.
And now I'm a little better now. And so that was just a huge, that just made a big difference to me. And I guess, you know, it had been 30 years of being alone with a living nightmare.
So was 18 months of that therapy enough, do you think?
No, it wasn't. And I say it was 18 months because after 18 months, my mother is diagnosed with cancer and dies. And so at that point, I wasn't able to do any more group work because my mother was terminally ill and died, you know. So my life was in another kind of crisis,
right,
which was completely unforeseen. It was just like, okay, I've been standing on the highway for years trying not to get run over by trucks, and then this aeroplane comes out of the air and lands on me. It was another crisis that I just didn't see coming.
Your mother's crisis, did that require you to step in and manage the family affairs and interrupt your own life again?
What there was of it, yes, because I was the sort of primary sort of person there, to organise what was happening for her. And there's a lot involved in that, really. It did. And I stayed in outpatient groups all during that time, which was a mistake. So I say, to me, my work there was only 18 months, but I actually stayed longer than that. But once my mother was diagnosed with cancer, I couldn't do any work on myself because I was living my actual life. Once I left group, my life was a crisis. And so I was spending 20 hours a week with people who wanted to kill themselves, and of course they're working on it. And then I would go out into the world and the one person that I loved was dying. And that was my life for 6 months while she died, and then...
So those circumstances caused your life to be taken over again by family that had treated you very badly for 20-odd years. Somewhat ironic.
Well, there's plenty of irony, like I said. My whole life is very ironic, really,
But you're doing this interview today. You're sounding incredibly well, cohesive, articulate. Obviously, there's been a huge change in the last 5 or 6 years.
I did the hard yards, really, and I spent 14 years in individual psychotherapy every week, and that effectively was the hard yards of getting better, really. And once I hit 41, I stopped being afraid all the time, really. Once I got to 41, that was 14 years of psychotherapy, I'd moved through the processes of dealing with the relationship with my father, my relationship with my mother, and I just stopped being afraid. And I remember being in EPS and I was having another sort of panic episode, and all of a sudden I remembered I wasn't afraid of all the staff. And that was amazing. That had never happened before.
Well, what strategies would you particularly say have been very positive for your recovery?
It's really hard to summate because it was a long time. And I guess, for me, you want to give hope to people. You want to say, don't give up. But I guess it's hard to do that, and because hope is a very individual thing, really. And I guess all I can do is, try and be a role model. Say, I got through this, and so I believe that other people can too. Really,
have you told this story very often in wanting to be a role model? I mean, telling our story is one way of performing that role, isn't it? Have you done that in places?
I've tried at different times, but there often isn't the forum, really. And, of course, most people's lives, thankfully, don't resemble mine. At times I do, there are times when I do. I just, the opportunity doesn't always come up, really.
And I guess, as you mentioned to me in our phone conversation last week, you live in a small community, and so I guess you're more identifiable, which can often, discourage us from telling our story, because then everybody knows.
Yeah, I don't mind people knowing, because I feel strong enough, and largely pretty much all of it was largely out of my control. It's more there's sort of stigma associated with it, which is most unfortunate. Again, that's out of my control too. I guess obviously my life only really started when I was 41. So I'm still really working on trying to get my life together. I feel like I'm 20 years old, really.
Wow.
And so I haven't quite... I've achieved some things, but I haven't achieved everything, and I guess that's one of them, is how I'm going to contribute back to making a difference.
Well, that's a very wonderful thought to have. with what you've been through, I rather wonder whether that's a luxury that you can afford working on yourself. But
you're with Take It From Us on 104.6 Planet FM.
And I'm Sheldon Brown, host of Mental Health Radio Take It From Us, a very courageous story of her personal journey by Liz. And that will be up on our website in the next couple of days on www.takeitfromus.co.nz. Just to finish, I have been promoting the fact that a colleague of mine in mental health, Shona Clark, is doing a research study which involves service users' experience of compulsory inpatient treatment under the Mental Health Act, and she's doing a master's research into this particular subject. She has expanded this to go national, asking for people that have been in an inpatient unit under the Mental Health Act to find out if there were any actions that could be taken to improve the experience for people. So you can contact Shona at either email, and her email address is scla069@aucklanduni.ac.nz, or you could phone or text her on 0210 890 2255. That mobile number is 0210 890 2255, to assist Shona in her research study about service users' experience of compulsory inpatient treatment under the Mental Health Act. Well, that's been Take It From Us. We've got Declan Curran here. We're going out on a little bit of music.
Yeah, I've come down off my ceiling fan now. I think all the fun we've had before. I just want to say before we go out that when you're feeling really down, I have a saying I say to people, it's head up, young person. I know it's not an easy thing to go through, but we're all thinking of you if you are going through anything like that, and just keep on fighting on. All right, we're back for another week, aren't we?
Next week. Tuesday.
Yep, all right, here comes that track. Catch you then.
If you ever find yourself stuck in the middle of the sea, I'll sail the world to find you. If you ever find yourself lost in the dark and you can't see, I'll be the light to guide you. Find out what we're made of when we are called to help our friends in need. You can count on. Are supposed to do, oh yeah. Ooh, ooh, yeah, yeah. If you're tossing and you're turning and you just can't fall asleep, I'll sing a song beside you. And if you ever forget how